Welcome to the Connected Insurance Podcast, presented by Agency Revolution. Listen to interviews with the most influential people in the insurance industry. Learn the most important strategies, tactics, trends, and challenges facing today's independent insurance agents and brokers. New episodes every Wednesday. Visit agencyrevolution.com and click media to explore the Connected Insurance family of resources for insurance agents and brokers. Subscribe today and get updates delivered right to your inbox. And now, without further delay, the Connected Insurance Podcast.
Hello, everybody. This is Michael Janz, founder of Agency Revolution, where we automate your systems, engage your customers, and help grow your agency. And I want to welcome you to this episode of the Connected Insurance Podcast, where it's our job to find the movers and shakers, disruptors and innovators in the industry, and discern and deconstruct what they're doing to help you grow your agency or brokerage faster. And I think I can promise you that this conversation for a lot of you will be a very important conversation to be a part of. I interview the person that I consider to be clearly one of the premier merger and acquisition specialists in the industry. He's been at it in this industry for almost 25 years and then going back outside the industry for almost 40 years. Larry Morrison is the president of Business Transition Network. He has too many credentials in the industry for me to read and to allow time for the conversation itself. He does hold two credentials that allow him to appraise the work of other appraisers. So here's a guy who really knows what he's talking about. And by the way, full disclosure, I used Larry, I think about 17 years ago, to assist in the very successful sale of a previous company that I owned. So in this conversation, we talk about the superheated M&A environment that we're all operating in right now, the forces that are driving it, and where those forces might take us in the future. And then we dive into some very practical tips and techniques on what agency principals should do. Short term, like immediately, medium term to position your agency for the highest possible multiples, and then long term for the kind of exit strategy that would be the most favorable for you. We also talk about some things that I know are issues that a lot of my clients deal with, multi-generation issues, internal perpetuation versus external perpetuation, what to do when there are multi-principals in an agency. So this is not just a trends report, but the way I like it, we also end up with some very practical and tactical issues. So in a moment, I'm going to introduce you to my friend Larry Morrison, and I hope this is going to be a conversation that you pay a lot of attention to. Meanwhile, I want to ask you a thing or two. I get feedback on this podcast regularly on LinkedIn and occasionally in my email. I like your feedback. I want to hear what you want to hear about. And I also would like to know if you have colleagues, friends, or contacts that you think I should be interviewing. Share those names with me, and I will do my best to reach out to them and bring them into this series. Also, as a favor to me and to the industry, perhaps, if you listen to a podcast and you like it, if you'd be kind enough to share it or make a comment about it on LinkedIn, that would mean a great deal to me. So I would appreciate that. So now, without further ado, I want to introduce you to my friend, M&A expert, Larry Morrison. Larry Morrison, so good to have you with us today. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to be with you, Michael.
So I'm really excited. I've been looking forward to this conversation with you because it seems to me that we're living in a bit of a crazy world, that the environment that you operate in, mergers and acquisitions, is maybe a little bit different or a little bit, you like me, have been in this industry for a long time. We counted in decades, not years. And clearly, over that period of time, things have changed. What is happening right now?
Right now, today, prices for agencies are higher than they've ever been in our entire careers. insurance industry, and furthermore, the highest they've ever been. They've stabilized at that high level for the last 12 to 18 months.
Okay.
But there's no sign that they're starting to decline.
All right. So let's talk about the reasons why. What's going on behind it? What are the forces that are driving that activity?
It depends on which level you look at.
Okay.
On the surface, the thing that's driving it is private equity.
Uh-huh.
Private equity is accounting for literally over half of all reported transactions. That's insane. If you go back to 2012, when private equity was already big, they accounted for about 34%. The latest data for the last 18 months is 52%.
Okay. So what's interesting is that about half of them are not being controlled by private equity, and I'm going to dig into that part later. But let's focus on this one because it seems that it's having a huge influence on this industry. What is it about the industry that's attracting private equity, and what is it that's attracting private equity now?
I'll take it each step at a time here.
Okay.
The thing about our industry that's attracting private equity is that to the private equity people, they believe, in most cases, rightly so, that they can buy agencies and those agencies will retain their value after the sale. That's sort of essential to them.
Right. But that's always been true, right? Agencies really do a terrific job of retaining value after a transition.
Yes.
Okay.
But there's another level here. The second part, of course, is they believe that if they make a bigger pie, they combine multiple agencies together, that bigger pie will be saleable at a higher multiple than they paid for each of the individual slices of that pie. So that's their business model. They think they're aggregators is another way to look at it. But
right.
They think that by buying a bunch of agencies, combining them together, they're adding value even if they don't add a single dollar of commissions relative to what they were independently.
Right. Okay. So the argument is that there's more value and there are higher multiples and a larger size.
That's a big part of it.
And so on the surface, that's probably true. But is there a... Is there a but to that?
So
number one, it can't go on forever.
It can't.
Okay.
The numbers don't make sense financially.
Right.
Pretty much anybody who actually crunches the numbers would say, this is crazy. But nobody knows how long it will be before the, quote, can't go on forever happens.
Right. Okay.
There's a reason.
Okay.
Private equity has more money flowing into it right now than it has ever had flowing into it before.
And that's because of what, Larry?
The stock market, and actually, for that matter, the financial markets in general.
Uh-huh.
The stock market's the easiest one to look at, but everybody knows interest rates, for instance, are drastically lower than they've ever been before also. So what's happening is large investors, either very wealthy individuals or, for that matter, large institutional investors, such as the state of California even, which is about as large an institutional investor as you'll find.
Yeah.
Large institutional investors are worried that interest rates are too low, and when they go up, the price of their investments in bonds goes down. That's just a mathematical relationship.
Right.
And second, that the stock market is at an all-time high relative to underlying earnings. That combination spooks a lot of sophisticated large investors. They don't want to be caught holding the bag when that finally turns the other direction. And it will.
Uh-huh.
Historically, it always does. This won't be an exception. But no one can ever say when that will happen. So what they're doing is they're trying to diversify. They're scared of having all their eggs in a basket that they know is someday going to go down.
Right.
And they're looking for other places that they can put that money that provides a better return on investment by far than they can in a traditional investment, and that also provides some diversification.
Right.
So at the end of the day, large, sophisticated investors have been pouring billions into private equity. It's not just being invested in agencies either. It's being invested in any kind of business they can find that they think will hold value.
Yeah, okay.
And can be resold later at a higher multiple.
Software companies, for example.
Absolutely.
Okay. Right.
That's a great example.
Okay, so what is going to trigger the end of this party?
When the financial markets turn around, it's almost certain to end this party. The private equity investors' incentive to get their money out of more traditional places to invest will end. Because the bubble in those investments, when it pops, they become attractive investments again. So the incentive to put money into private equity goes away.
Uh-huh.
When the money going into private equity goes away, then private equity investment in our industry goes away too.
Okay. Very big picture. So when it goes away from private equity, where's the money going to go?
Back into traditional investments.
Got it.
And second, there won't be as much money for a while either because traditional investments will have gone down in value. So it's going to be two things. One, there's less money available to invest. And two, the incentive to put it into what is, in fact, more complex investments goes down.
Got it.
By a lot.
All right. So, Larry, it's a little bit of a fool's game to make predictions about the future. We've seen people make a lot of predictions about our industry in the past that haven't necessarily come to fruition. So I'm not going to ask you to say when. That just doesn't seem to be fair. But what I want to dig into, so for our audience, I want to deliver practical tools and things that people can execute on. So let's bring this down to agency operations. People who are listening, many people who are listening to this are perhaps agency principals. They're responsible for running an agency. Let's see what we can do to make your wisdom practical. Short term, medium term, long term, what is an agent to do to maximize their upside potential?
Well, we could spend many podcasts to cover that in any kind of depth.
And Larry will do another one. So, but
okay.
Where do you want to start?
Well, I look forward to that. I can give you some high-level tips.
Okay.
Number one, don't overpay, especially if you're in a position where the amount you pay could put you under if it turns out that the industry goes south.
Ah.
So you've heard the old cliche, buy low, sell high?
Right.
Well, the opposite of that cliche is don't buy high, sell low.
Okay. So
there's wisdom in that.
Yeah. All right. So so there's a business model that works for private equity, the aggregation business model, that you're saying is not the game that an independent agency should play if they're in the acquisition game.
Most independent agencies do not have incredibly deep pockets.
Right.
They have deep enough pockets to buy, however. So the key, if you're a buyer, and there are situations where it makes sense to be a buyer,
right,
the key is the terms. You can, in fact, even in today's inflated environment, you can design a sale that will pencil out for you, the buyer. It won't pencil out as easily as it did 15 years ago.
Right.
But you can design it so it will pencil out.
Why would
you're
that?
Also,
yeah, okay.
You're also closer to the real world. So when you look at an agency, your perspective is, will this actually add value to my agency if we combine the two or if we buy that book of business?
Right.
Make sure you crunch the numbers honestly with yourself. If the only reason the agency you're buying is for sale is because there's problems, well, do you really think, given the price and the terms that you're thinking about paying, that when you combine it together, it will make you money? And the only way to do that is to crunch the numbers. You can't, no one knows the future, but you can crunch the numbers based on a realistic expectation that you, because you're deeply involved in the industry, will have a good idea about.
Got it.
If it makes sense under those conditions, you can, in fact, do reasonable acquisitions today.
Okay. So I want to circle back to something you said about 2 or 3 minutes ago. You said, use the term, if the industry goes south. What do you mean by that?
Well, when I'm talking about the industry going south, there's two parts to that. One, pricing at some point will turn around when the stock market and the financial markets in general turn around.
All right.
That will open up some opportunities if you're a buyer.
Mm-hmm.
Second, we've already lived through one fairly major financial crisis, and a whole lot of agencies have still fresh memories of just how fun that was.
Pretty fresh, yes.
Yes. Well, it's going to be equally fun the next time that happens.
Uh-huh.
Agencies survived that far better than most closely held businesses did, but it's still not fun.
Right.
What will happen is agency revenues for most agencies will at least fall. They may not fall catastrophically. It depends on the kind of business your agency writes. But most agencies did see a decline in revenue.
Right.
I'm not saying all, but most did.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to get hit with a double whammy. Good chance revenue will decline. Good chance your agency will survive that. Almost all agencies did.
Right.
It won't be fun. And the prices that people are willing to pay for agencies will go down. So two things will happen, both of those. The effect of declining revenue is not going to be permanent. The effect of declining prices, well, we're at ridiculous prices now. Presumably a change in those will be permanent, and it will make buying agencies a lot more reasonable. Both of those will happen. You haven't asked me about the other side of this same coin.
Right.
When is a good time to sell?
Yeah.
Well, the standard book answer that I'm giving people, and I think a lot of other people are too, is if you plan to sell sometime within the next 5 years.
Right.
You ought to consider selling now. And if you're going to do that, you owe it to yourself to do that right.
Okay. So first obvious question, why is that?
Well, it's an obvious answer.
Okay.
Prices are better right now.
Yeah, okay. And the future's unpredictable.
The future, unpredictable. But if you know you're going to retire in the relatively near term, 5 years is pulled out of the air.
Okay.
For some people, if it's 5 years, they're better off waiting. But, you know, if it's 2 years, there's a real good chance now is when you ought to think about
okay.
it.
Okay. Talk to us. So in that situation, talk to us about the distinctions between internal and external perpetuation.
Internal perpetuation can be made as good as an external sale.
Ah.
to internal perpetuation is not can you do it, it's do you have somebody internally that you have enough confidence in that you will feel good enough to have them owe you money over a long period of time.
And between price and terms, is it competitive with external perpetuation? And here's the reason I'm asking, having just recently attended an industry conference and listened to a different M&A specialist deal with this. It seems that the external perpetuation multiples are higher than the internal perpetuation multiples in general.
In general, they are.
Okay.
And the reason that most M&A people are suggesting external, I hate to say this, but
right.
It's partly because they will facilitate the sale and take a success fee when
Got
it's sold.
Got it. Okay. Got it.
They did add value. I'm not saying they didn't earn their fee.
Right.
But it can color their view.
Okay.
The second part of it.
Yeah.
The second part of it is that it is true most agencies don't have somebody that can step in and fill the owner's shoes.
Okay. So I want to ask a very practical question. We have a lot of clients who are multi-generation agencies. And in a lot of those agencies, there has been a dream that the agency would be passed on from dad to the next generation. So there's another value at play, right?
Absolutely.
There's another value. Is there generally some financial sacrifice that may likely happen in that kind of an internal perpetuation? In other words,
maybe yes, maybe no.
Okay, talk to us a little bit about that one.
The IRS is terrified that parents will do something nice for their kids.
Okay, right.
Thus reducing the amount of tax they collect.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're going to insist on is that the price is a market price. And in a pure family transaction, you're going to need to have it appraised in order to convince the IRS that, yes, in fact, it's current fair market value. However, they also say the terms have to be reasonable and typical. Well, guess what? No one can define what that is.
Okay.
So we have a huge amount of flexibility with the terms.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that you can do in a family transaction, number one, you will need to have the appraisal, but number two, the terms can be designed so that the risk to the kids is drastically reduced, and effectively what's happening is parent and child are sharing that risk into the future. Part of the price is usually fixed.
Yeah.
But part of the price is dependent on future results. That's generally called an earnout.
Mm-hmm.
We can do that, and we can put a big portion of the sale price into an earnout, whereas most private equity buyers also use an earnout, but the proportion of the sale in the earnout is much less. So we can play around with the terms. We can design something that, in fact, on paper, matches the best that you could get in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
And the IRS has some extra incentive to make sure you do it that way.
Got it. Okay.
But nevertheless, we can get there from here.
Okay. So that seems like it may be a good segue to the other side of the equation. So you said that almost 50% of the acquisitions are not being performed by private equity. So presumably most of those are being performed agency to agency.
Yes, right? They are. Or internal. Agency.
Yeah, okay, or internal. And also presumably some of them are not well done, but some of them presumably are well done. In other words, terms and price that is satisfactory to everybody. So for those who are seriously interested in growth through acquisition in this kind of troubling or difficult, superheated acquisition market, You said it comes down to terms because you're probably not going to be able to compete on price. Tell us in practical terms, what does that mean?
Okay, actually, terms are more important than price. If what you're doing is looking at things on an annual after-tax basis, you can design terms. Generally, you're going to have to stretch them out in today's market to 10 years or even more.
Okay. Uh-huh.
You can design terms that will pencil out for the buyer. You can also put an earn-out element in there that will protect the buyer in
right.
the event of things turning around and going south for a while.
Yeah.
If you do that, it is reasonable, and if I were advising the seller in a transaction like this, I would insist on it. The earn-out needs to work both ways, so that if things go well, the seller prospers. The seller is giving up some certainty with an earn-out, and in exchange, they should be compensated for giving that certainty up by also sharing at least somewhat in the upside.
Got it. Okay. So, in practical terms, for agencies today, there are probably some things that they should be doing immediately or in the short term. There are some things they should be doing in the medium term, and then ultimately they should be thinking about their long-term exit strategy. Let's start with, like, today. When you take on a new client who wants to either sell or buy, what do you like to see, and what are the things, sometimes the things that you see that you just wish weren't there?
Number one, make sure you put your best foot forward before you actually have conversations with potential buyers.
What does that mean?
That means any financial information that you share needs to be presented in a way that fairly shows the benefits of ownership in your agency. Your reported bottom line profit is not that number.
Got it. Okay. So
nor is your quote EBITDA.
Uh-huh.
EBITDA, that stands for earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, is an acronym that gets thrown around a lot, but it's not what people actually use. It's a starting point. What people use is a before-tax estimate of what the business really generates economically after backing out all the various ways an owner benefits from ownership, which generally results in a lot of adjustments to the bottom line.
Got it. Okay.
That's not part of EBITDA. But it's the biggest adjustment to the bottom line, and that's what tends to push a person's before-tax available cash flow number way up.
So if an agency is interested in selling, you're saying they should do some homework first. They should get their house in order first.
Absolutely, and part of that is being able to show a prospective buyer what they actually are going to get versus what it looks like on the surface. A prospective buyer will try to estimate that, but they don't really want that number to be ridiculously high. They'll make the obvious estimate,
right,
and then they'll explain to you what a wonderful multiple of that number they're going to pay you.
Right.
But there's probably a number of other adjustments that they can't possibly know about. It's up to you to make sure that you've presented that properly. I've got an example of a client right now.
Yeah.
Who was contacted by a private equity-backed buyer, didn't put their best foot forward, and the private equity buyer made some adjustments, concluded that they didn't meet their minimum requirements and advised them to go find another agency to sell to instead.
Yeah.
Well, that's when they contacted me. We redid their financial so that it showed what is actually there. The next private equity buyer that came along, and by the way, that's pretty common for them to
right.
keep coming along,
yeah.
Was quite excited about it, and it looks like they've got a sale.
Okay, good.
Same criteria.
Uh-huh.
In one case, they've got a really attractive sale. In the other case, the buyer even went away. So put your best foot forward. It
okay.
makes a huge difference.
All right. So there's let's kind of move on to medium term. So it would seem that obviously there are certain things that are attractive to a buyer. It would seem, you know, obviously the revenue matters and the margins matter. And it would seem that having an agency that has a proven track record of growth, some sales velocity or, you know, some systematic way for and proven way that demonstrates growth would be valuable. What are
hugely valuable?
Oh, okay, so and that's rare. You know, I think I saw that last year agencies grew on average. I think it was 4.2%. So if an agency has, let's say, an agency has a 15% or 20% growth rate or higher, that's of value to a buyer, isn't it?
It's of more value than most sellers can even imagine.
Okay, got it. Well, that's obviously it's music to my ears because I've been in the growth business for 25 years. I'm not ready to sell now, but an agency's, you know, thinking I want to sell 3 years from now or 5 years from now or 7 years from now. What are some of the things that you think agencies should put in place to make themselves as attractive as possible?
There's two things involved there. One of them, a buyer will look at your historical growth rate.
Mm-hmm.
Second, that doesn't really matter to them if they also conclude that that growth can't be sustained. So they're going to look at your historical growth rate as a starting point. Second, they're going to want to confirm to themselves that the reason you've been growing is sustainable. In other words, you actually know how to market.
Got it. All right.
Most agencies don't.
Mm-hmm.
But you do. You can show it's sustainable. There is a third piece there, too. They're looking at the potential market in the area you're in.
Ah.
So they want to see, number one, you know how to market, and you've proven it. Number two, the amount of growth you've already achieved can be sustained at least for the next few years if they buy your agency. So that's critical, and I'll give you an example. If you raise the growth rate from 4.2 to 7.2, and overall, your attractiveness is marginal. Okay? In other words, if you have high attractiveness, the difference will be more pronounced than I just gave you.
Okay, right.
But if you move it up just 3%, then the multiple that their internal calculations will show for your agency will be at least 6.7, and in today's marketplace, probably between 7 and 8, minimum 6.7. Just showing a 3% per year increase above the average that's sustainable.
Yeah. Okay, so
we'll raise the floor.
So let me ask you another question, all right, because we have encountered this in the industry from time to time where an agency, they want to grow, but they want to maintain the high, like a private equity firm is demanding, you know, we the highest possible EBITDA, the highest possible margin. And so they refuse to invest in growth because they see that as an expense.
Well,
now maybe that's appropriate if the deal is like, okay, you know, we're in the deal now or it's 6 months from now. But it seems like, what is it, penny wise and pound foolish, if it's beyond that.
Well, let me give you examples.
Help me out, yes.
Okay.
I picked
a very achievable increase, just 3%.
Right.
That would add about 1.5 to the multiple, all by itself, just 3%. Now, let's look at what the marketplace, at least what the buyers in the private equity world, are looking at as their sweet spot.
Yeah.
They want to see, on an adjusted basis, a so-called EBITDA. Remember,
yeah,
there's a lot more to it than
right,
that.
Right, right, okay.
They want to see an EBITDA of 30%.
Right, okay.
Or more.
Yep.
That is actually more achievable than a lot of people think, partly through things the private equity buyer is going to do, such as cut renewal commission rates. But at the end of the day, they want to see 30%, and they want to have some kind of indication that you can really make that happen. Second, they will put money into an earnout. To get a high multiple, they're going to be looking for something sustainable north of 5%, or they won't put a high multiple on the fundamental fixed price portion.
So I'm sorry, 5% what?
5% internal growth per year. They want to see something north of that. Second, to get the earnout portion, they're looking at 15% compound growth per year, depending on the buyer, for the next 2 to 3 years. If you really know how to market, you can do that. But most agencies cannot.
Those are sustainable, easily sustainable numbers. They're just hard if you're not willing to invest in
marketing, right?
You need some of the
that's
tools.
Right.
So that's been that's been a little bit of a, it's been an interesting conversation from time to time in the industry where somebody wants growth and yet they're saying I can't invest in it because, you know, the private equity firm that I'm talking to doesn't want me to spend any money. And again, is it maybe that's a conversation that makes sense if you're in the conversation now, but it seems to make no sense if you're interested in achieving the highest possible multiples in the future.
Okay, there's an easy answer to that one, too.
I love easy answers.
Yeah. Now, remember, the private equity firm is looking at how big you are to start with.
Right.
So if you got bigger, that's adding value all by itself.
Got it.
Second, when they look at your EBITDA number, there's nothing that says the EBITDA can't have optional adjustments built in. That you can make the case to the private equity buyer that you think those things should continue. But they don't necessarily have to. And so if you have a marketing program in place and it is hitting your EBITDA, especially when you first start it, that shows up on your EBITDA number as an investment in the future. It is not, and this is, by the way, the correct way to look at it, it is not an ongoing operating expense. It's an investment in the future, especially when you start. Once it's up and running and is an integral part of what's making your agency grow, it flips over into operating
expense. Got it. Okay.
But it is not up front. And therefore, if you spent that money up front and the private equity firm needs you to hit 30%, all of that is one of those adjustments.
Got it. All right.
It's a separate sales issue
between
the agency owner and the private equity group as to whether or not you continue that.
Got it.
And, right.
Well, if your earnout depends upon some future growth, then you're probably going to argue that that operating expense should be continued. Yeah,
that's right.
Okay.
But that, now there's another piece that almost everyone overlooks.
Uh-huh.
The private equity people have a lot of money behind them, but the private equity M&A person you're talking to has to sell the deal to the green eyeshade guys in the background.
Right, yep.
He needs to hit their numbers. So if you make it easy to hit their numbers, then that's the hardest single piece. You're now there.
Right.
It's easier for that person to sell the idea that, oh, by the way, we need to invest in the future here, it's working, than it is to sell the idea that, well, they don't hit the numbers up front, but we think they're still worth buying.
Got it.
Much easier sale.
Okay. So my next question, Larry, is about what's your advice regarding long-term strategy? And to some extent, I think you've already answered that. Now, you might have something else to add, but it seems that you're part of your best long-term strategy to achieve the highest possible multiples is to run a really well-run agency with a good track record of growth.
Unquestionably so.
Okay.
Now, there is something I want to add.
Yeah.
And this only applies to multi-owner agencies, but there's a lot of them out there.
Yeah, there are a lot of those too. Okay.
You need to have, if you have more than one owner, you need to have a shareholders agreement.
Yeah.
You need to have a mechanism that can keep one of your owners from blocking a sale. If everybody wants to sell except one owner, you need to have a way to compel everybody to go along with it.
Got it.
That may sound, well, we all get along. Why would we need that?
Yeah.
I have personal experience with two separate agencies in two separate states that were the dominant agencies in their state.
Uh-huh.
So these are not small potatoes. They're major players. Both of them had a fair number of owners. And both of them, I was on one side of the table for one and the other side of the table for the other. Both of them ended up, this was a while back, both of them ended up getting offers in the neighborhood of 14 times adjusted EBITDA.
Yeah.
You could do even slightly better than that today,
which
for an agency as desirable as they were.
Okay.
I mean, they were the primo of the primo.
Okay. By the way, that's the first time in this conversation we've actually thrown out a number.
Well, 14
for
is not something most people will hit.
Yeah.
But if you're in that category, you can get 14 in today's market. Well, or 15,
yeah,
which is science fiction. But
right,
both of those sales fell
uh-huh
through.
Yeah, okay. That's EBITDA. Let's be clear about that. That's EBITDA.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
All right.
Both of those sales fell through, and both of them did have adjusted EBITDA of over 30. I think one of them was over 40.
Wow.
We were talking really big sales. They were blocked, both of them, because the buyer wasn't willing to buy unless they could get it all.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, that was a wow.
Well,
I'm still shocked.
So
2 years ago.
So I think what you're saying is, folks, if you have multiple owners, that's a conversation you should have now as opposed to when you get approached by private equity and you start throwing a lot of time and energy into shareholder conversations.
Take care of it.
Okay, got it.
Yep.
All right. Larry, I'm going to ask you an oddball question. You've been at this. How long have you been doing this?
Since 1991.
Okay.
I was involved in M&A outside this industry before that.
Yeah,
which is
petroleum.
Where I learned how to do
right
that.
As I recall, wasn't it?
Yeah, I did some M&A for Chevron as well as some M&A for another, at the time independent, but giant petroleum company, which ended up being bought by BP. That one was Ohio.
Yeah.
So I did learn how to do it from the big company standpoint.
By the way, I'll remind you, you also were responsible for the successful sale of an association management firm about 17 years ago or something.
Yes, that's true.
Okay.
you might know a little about that one.
It was mine for the listeners.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So what do you think is the worst piece of advice that agents get about this field from time to time? Yeah.
That's the target-rich environment.
That's a target-rich environment. Okay. So when you said, oh, man, it's not because you were having a hard time thinking of anything.
The hard part is figuring out the worst.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so
The worst advice I can think of is ignore cash flow and focus just on a multiple of commissions if you're the buyer.
Ah, okay. That's bad advice. Bad advice.
Terrible advice.
Okay. All right.
Now, you do need to look at cash flow in your hands. That's not the same as cash flow in the seller's hands.
Got it. Uh-huh. Right.
But cash flow is what matters, not top-line revenue. And you owe it to yourself to look at cash flow.
Got it. Okay. All right. I have one final question for you. And you can answer this one any way that you want, because you're not only, you know, one of the industry's premier merger and acquisition specialists, but you've been an observer of this space for a long time. You've been a studied observer of this space for a long time. So imagine the industry's zipping down insurance highway at 65 miles an hour, and Larry Morrison gets to put up a billboard. If there are probably more than six or seven or eight words on that billboard, nobody's going to be able to read it. If you wanted to say something that mattered to the industry as it's going down the highway really fast, what do you want to say? In the fewest words possible, what do you want to say that matters?
Boy, that's a really tough question.
You thought I was going to throw you softballs the whole time?
Yeah. Well, you didn't, that's for sure. Make sure you put your best foot forward.
Got it. Okay. Larry, if people want to reach you or find out more about you, first of all, what is the kind of person or agency that you most want to have a conversation or relationship with? And then secondly, how can people make contact with you or ask you questions?
Sure. I work strictly by referral or from people who listen to something like this. I don't even have a website. So you need to know how to reach me, or you need to be referred to me by somebody I've worked with in the past.
Okay. I'm in that group.
So you could certainly contact Michael Jan.
Okay.
Or Agency Revolution.
Yeah.
My email address is larry.morrison@comcast.net. My phone number is 866-475-9992. And at some point in the future, which is thus far unknown, I may actually put together a website. But thus far, I managed to stay busy without it.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. You are among the weakest marketers that I've known in my career, and it seems to serve you absolutely fine.
Well, I agree with both of those statements.
Yeah, I know. I have never known you not busy, and hopefully some of your busyness comes from referrals from me, but I'm sure it's a minority.
I get referrals from a lot of prior clients as well, which I treasure. And the reason is the best compliment you can get is somebody you've worked with that recommends you to someone else.
Indeed, that's true. Well, Larry, I am extremely grateful for how generous you were sharing your expertise on this call. I think it's a really important topic and a really timely topic right now for lots of reasons. So on behalf of the audience, I want to say thank you very, very much for spending time with us.
Well, thank you, Michael. This is very fun. I enjoy doing it.
All right. Have a great day, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot. Talk to you later.
Thank you for listening to the Connected Insurance Podcast. If you found this episode informative, please share it with your peers and colleagues. Explore the Connected Insurance family of resources for insurance agents and brokers by visiting agencyrevolution.com and clicking media. Subscribe and get updates delivered right to your inbox. New episodes every Wednesday.